Hello, I'm Billion Chung. This is number 0275, the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File Program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you, and yes, this is indeed another edition of the Stuff File program, number 0275. And coming up on this edition of the Stuff File program, we have another visit from Rocky Lang, the author of If You Thought Your Divorce Was Bad, Wait Until You Read This Book.
The genesis of this book was that I realized as I was going through my divorce that getting the divorce was more difficult than the marriage that got me there. And that was the basis of an article that I wrote for the Huffington Post called Sleazy Legal, which was my need to cheap out on the divorce and hire a paralegal service rather than a lawyer. And it took me down a road to essentially hell. As my dad had said to me, he says, you know, never drink cheap wine and never buy cheap condoms and don't hire cheap lawyers. And I did, and I got burned for that.
Science writer Andrew Vazekas, the night sky guy, talks about Philae, the satellite that landed on a comet.
I think all the excitement about that's got everybody on the edge of their seats is that we're vicariously living through this tiny washing machine-sized robot that touched down on this high-speed, mountain-sized ice ball that's careening through the inner solar system. And we're looking through its digital eyes and just seeing that it's an alien world that we're visiting. No human eye has ever seen it.
Mike Side, author of Chuck and Chuck, The Astonishing Tale of Charles Manson, a novel about Charles Manson getting to pitch in the major leagues. How did Mike feel about the recent news about Charles Manson about to get married?
As art imitating life or life imitating art would have it, I didn't think in real life this would ever happen, but without giving too many spoilers away about the book, something similar happens in the book. And so when I heard this, I couldn't believe it. I had to crack up. But no, I didn't think in real life this would happen. But like you say, truth is stranger than fiction.
And we have lots and lots and lots of stuff. And of course, an idiot of the day. The guest Slater, the person who told you this was show number 0275, was Billiam Chung, a 13-year-old student at Heng Yi High School in Taipei. And he probably gets to hear the Stuff File program via PCJ Media in Taiwan. Thank you very much, Billiam, for doing the guest slate on this edition of the Stuff File program, a program that's also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, let's get right to the stuff, shall we? Now, in this politically correct world we live in, we no longer make stereotypical jokes about ethnic groups like we once used to, because we have come around to the fact that while some folks do live up to certain stereotypes, it is an individual situation and not one that speaks for an entire tribe. Still, said tribe can't be happy with the negative press when one of their brethren steps out into that stereotype third rail. Case in point is a story that comes to us from Poland. Winnie the Pooh is being run out of town, and it's not for taking all the honey. The cartoon bear's image was banned from a playground in the small Polish city of Tuschyn because members of the town council believe him to be a hermaphrodite. The issue came up when it was proposed that Pooh be the patron of the playground, but the more conservative members of the council took issue with the fact that he only is half-dressed. It doesn't wear underpants because it doesn't have a sex. It's a hermaphrodite, said one councillor. They had an explanation for why poor Pooh is of dubious sexuality, and it's through no fault of his own, but rather due to the cruelty of his author, A.A. Milne. This is very disturbing, but can you imagine? The author is over 60 and cut off Pooh's testicles with a razor blade because he had a problem with his identity. Those are the words of Councillor Hannah Jamsika. The patron of the playground has yet to be decided, but Winnie the Pooh has been scratched off the list. Well, if you ask me, I think the councillor is projecting some of their own issues on this topic, But this story does bring new meaning to the term Polish joke. And in a somewhat creepy related story, here is a quote from a grandmother of a toddler. It's not very nice for a 3-year-old child. That's what a woman said after an incident in Dawlish, Devon, England. She says her daughter took her own daughter to a public toilet in town and surprised a couple in the baby changing room having full-blown sex. What was even more notable was that the man had a Winnie the Pooh Tigger outfit on and the woman was undressed. The couple slammed the door in the girl's face. Said Grandma, "This is a disgusting act and in a baby changing room." Well, now we know for sure that at least one Winnie the Pooh character is not a hermaphrodite. Actually, maybe the counselor from the previous story had a similar traumatizing experience in their childhood. That would certainly explain a lot. And moving right along, David Van Vliet asked for certain supposedly public records in Tacoma, Washington, and was forced into federal court when the city turned him down. Van Vliet wanted data from the city licenses of strip club employees, you know, dancers' stage names and real names and also their date of birth, etc., 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 so that he could pray for them individually by name to make his appeals more effective. In October, Judge Ronald Layton denied Van Vliet a temporary restraining order against the city. Gee, I was unaware that you needed someone's date of birth to pray for them. If you were that religious, wouldn't you think that God would know whom you were talking about in your prayers? I mean, the one thing I learned in church is that he's all-knowing and all-seeing. Anyway, we have one more story in this section of Stuff File News before we get to our first guest on the program here with me, Peter Anthony Holder. A woman described only as robust in Darmstadt, Germany, fled with the equivalent of about $125 from a pharmacy in October and is still at large. According to the police report, she swiped money from two cash registers by twice lifting her shirt and squirting breast milk at the clerk as a diversion. Seriously, I really have nothing to add to this one, but I'm guessing the police are still looking for the lactating larcenist. Anyway, let's get to our first guest, shall we? A few weeks ago, we spoke to Rocky Lang about his book, Growing Up Hollywood, Tales from the Son of a Hollywood Mogul. Well, at the time, I said that we would have him back on the show to talk about his other book called If You Thought Your Divorce Was Bad, Wait Until You Read This Book. So, he's back. Once again, Rocky joins us on the line from Los Angeles. Hi, Rocky.
Hi, Peter. How are you today?
Oh, just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program once again. The first thing that comes to my mind in seeing a story or seeing a book with this title, If You Thought Your Divorce Was Bad, Wait Until You Read This Book, is what does your ex think about this book?
Well, actually, the dedication to the book is to my ex-wife's ... So I'm not really writing a book particularly about them, although there are a few of my experiences in the book, but they are not named, and it wasn't the intention to slam them. It was more of a follow-up to the book we talked about a couple of years ago called Confessions of Emergency Room Doctors, which was a humor book, as you recall, about all the crazy things that happen in emergency rooms. So what the genesis of this book was is that I realized as I was going through my divorce that getting the divorce was more difficult than the marriage that got me there. And that was the basis of an article that I wrote for the Huffington Post called Sleazy Legal, which was my need to cheap out on the divorce and hire a paralegal service rather than a lawyer. And it took me down a road to essentially hell. As my dad had said to me, he says, you know, never drink cheap wine and never buy cheap condoms and don't hire cheap lawyers. And I did, and I got burned for that. So that article got a lot of sort of traction, and then it's got me thinking about all the craziness that people do around divorce and find humor in the situation.
Now, if I heard correctly there, when I mentioned ex-wives, you mentioned plural.
Plural, yes, plural.
Okay.
Yes.
So the fact that you said earlier that it was easier to get married than to get a divorce, did
What I was saying was the marriage that got me to the divorce was easier than getting the divorce.
Exactly. Well,
meaning that, yes.
Yeah. So, having said that, did it not make you gun shy to head down the aisle a second time?
Well, I was actually referring to the second marriage when I wrote The Sleazy Legal. The first marriage was a good marriage for some part of it, and the good thing about the best thing out of that is two incredible children who are now 23 and 19, and they have done incredibly well. And, you know, not to get into the serious side of this, but for me it was always eyes on the prize, so that, you know, my love for my children took precedent over my anger or hurt over the divorce. And so I tried very hard to, you know, build the bridge to the ex in order to protect the children's well-being. And they've done really well in it. The second marriage was, I would say, was a typical rebound marriage. And it was really the decade of death, so to speak. And it was a rebound marriage and something I should not have done. And not a bad person at all, but just a bad fit for me. In any event, the book is filled with anecdotes and funny stories and the craziness that people do, and you know, basically as Robin Williams had said, he said, divorce, from the Latin word meaning to rip out a man's genitals through his wallet, and though I've tried very hard to use both sides, so there's no attack on women and there's no attack on men. It's more on the craziness of what people do.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, and that is you just said it's rather gender neutral. So just like when people get married, you hear stories of bridezillas, but you don't necessarily hear about the angst and concern that men go through in those situations. When you're talking about divorce, are you talking about the bad behavior on both sides?
I think it's the extreme behavior, and it's the type of behavior where, as you know, you're voyeuristic and you want to look in. It's like some of the reality shows. You look in it, whether or not you're interested in Jerry Springer or not. You know, you're just sort of like you can't quite believe what people do, and you know, whether or not there's a story of a man in Detroit, and it was on the news a little bit. Some of your listeners may have even seen the story, but you know, he was so angry at his ex-wife, he wound up buying a house right next to hers and commissioning a $25,000 bronze sculpture of a finger. So, you know, a screw you type of thing, a gesture. And so no matter where she was in her house, she could see this. And, you know, that's an extreme behavior. An extreme behavior is, a man who gave a kidney to his wife during their marriage, and then they got divorced, and he wanted the kidney back, and he actually went to court saying that, you know, it was a gift, and therefore he wanted the gift returned. And you know, there are stories of there's very crazy stories, but I try to tell them in a humorous tone. That's really sort of what the tenure of the book is.
I'm hoping that the guy with the finger on the and the sculpture at least lit it up nicely at Christmas.
I think it was actually.
I have a
story here of a man and woman who got married, and they dated for a very long time. And once they got married, she got into bed fully clothed, and she said to him, "No, I'm just shy. I feel shy." So this went on for a year of her getting into bed with him and not getting undressed, and finally that led to a divorce. And it's a sort of a sequence of what's happening. There was a story of a man and woman who were together, and he was an obsessive cleaner. And he would become fixated on things, including a spot on a wall that wasn't there. And finally the wife came home, and he had had the wall taken down because he just couldn't look at that spot on the wall. And you know, there are other stories of couples that spent millions of dollars in litigation using all sorts of attorneys to the point where they were like War of the Roses, to such an extent where they wind up losing the house in the foreclosure because of what they did to each other. And so they all are really sort of cautionary tales, even though I'm hoping they're really funny and people find them amusing, again, in that voyeuristic way. But there are cautionary tales of saying, like, look at, let's take a look at this behavior, and is it really positive or good? Does anybody get anything out of it when these emotions are able to take such hold that you're doing the most ridiculous and crazy things?
Do you find often that there's it's not just a pent-up anger between the combatants when it comes to getting a divorce, but perhaps maybe the frenzy that is sometimes stirred up by competing attorneys?
Well, I think that's always a component. I have not really gone too much into that area because that becomes a whole other crazy thing. There was the story of a couple that had wanted their dream house, and they'd worked really hard for their dream house. And so what they did is they built the dream house. And then the problems came, and it was the kind of problems that were fighting over little things that became big things, such as, you know, what side of the toilet does the flush handle go? Whether he wanted to build an airplane-looking laboratory in the powder room in the bottom that looked like when you go into a 707 or 747 bathroom. You know, he wanted it to look like that. And she was like, "That's ridiculous." And so they wound up fighting this, and then ultimately getting divorced. They wanted to get divorced, and neither one of them would vacate the house. So they stayed in the house, and now they hired all these attorneys. And the attorney started to, defend them, and neither one would leave the house. And they wound up building a wall down the house and dividing it up. And now he knew that she hated, like, R&B rap music, so he started to play that type of music really loud in the house and have these wild parties. She wound up turning off the heat in the house over the winter and leaving the house, and he, like, was frozen out and had the pipes cut. And so this kind of – so certainly the lawyers then got involved with it. And the amount of money that was spent on lawyers wound up basically, he wasn't paying attention to his business, and the business sort of, like, got bad. And finally, they had spent so much money they had to leave the house. I mean, so the lawyers did get involved in that situation.
Wow. As fun as this book is, being someone who's never been married, after reading your book, why would I want to?
Well, look, I'm a really positive guy. I mean, in my story, Sleazy Legal, I tell an anecdote about my own child who said to me, in the midst of all this, she said, "Dad, you should start dating again. You, I'm sure you could find somebody." Because at that point, I had closed the door on it. And I said, "Hey, Nikki, here's the deal." I said, "When you go to the store to get a banana, do you get a yellow banana or a brown banana?" And she said, "Well, of course, I get a yellow banana." I said, "Exactly." I said, "When I go to the relationship store to get a banana, I get the brown banana. I always get the bruised fruit." And so, sort of a joke about it. But the end of the story is I met my yellow banana. I've never been more in love. I've never been more happy than I have the last 4 years with the woman that I'm with now. And so, maybe I'm the eternal romantic or optimist, but I believe that there is love and there is the right person for you. You just have to make the right decisions and look and be lucky. And that would be my message, is never give up on love.
Said by the guy who wrote the book, if you thought your divorce was bad, wait until you read this book. Rocky, thank you once again for being on the program. It's always a pleasure to talk to you, sir.
You're the best. Thank you very much.
Rocky Lang, author of If You Thought Your Divorce Was Bad, Wait Until You Read This Book. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for the show, which is show number 0275, and you'll find the links to Rocky's website, plus links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly.
You're listening to The Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Drop Peter a line. He'd love to hear from you. You can email him at peter@thestufffile.com or catch up with him on Twitter or Facebook. There's more Stuff File coming your way in just a few moments.
Kelly Alexander Show is your place to be for everything to do with health, lifestyle, and entertainment. Join us as we chat with celebrities like Emmy winner Mia Michaels from So You Think You Can Dance, best-selling recording artist Taylor Dane, and world-renowned astronaut Julie Payette. We also cover important topics like breast cancer awareness and how to help your child through bullying. All this and more, please join us, www.kellyalexandershow.com.
It's the Kelly Alexander Show.
Capture your need for sound.
Peter Anthony Holder here. Have you ever noticed on some of those public broadcasting pledge drives, they tend to sound like ransom demands in a kidnapping?
Hey, your kids like this, Mr. Rogers. It would be most unfortune if for some unforeseen reason, you weren't in the neighborhood no more.
Well, I'm here to ask for your support in a non-threatening, non-obligatory kind of way. Part of the success of the Stuff File depends on the generosity of its listeners worldwide. So if you can, and if you want, please feel free to make a small one-time donation. Just go to the website at thestufffile.com and click on the PayPal donation button. You can donate $10, $5, or even $1, whatever you'd like.
You know that big bird? That would be one huge drumstick, if you know what I mean.
If you have a PayPal account, it's an easy transfer. And if you don't, all major credit cards are accepted. Your generosity would be much appreciated in keeping this show running.
About that antique roadshow, they might be seeing a little more concrete than they originally anticipated.
No strong-arm tactics, no ransom demands. Just a simple please and thank you. To donate, visit thestufffile.com.
Coming to you from the outskirts of sanity, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to Andrew Vizekas, the night sky guy, about that lander that landed on a comet. Fascinating stuff. Plus, we'll meet the author of Chuck and Chuck, the astonishing tale of Charles Manson. And of course, we do indeed have an idiot of the day coming your way. And much more Stuff File news here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Well, Steve Sofer, who is the CEO of an international support group for people with shy bladders, excoriated DirecTV in November for its series of commercials featuring Rob Lowe, whose awkward character in one ad stands at a urinal and says, "Fact, I can't go with other people in the room." Sofer says the ad ridicules a serious problem and compared it to making fun of a man missing an arm or a leg. Really? Really? You know, I'm sure if there is someone listening to this right now who is missing either an arm or a leg or both, they're probably feeling sorry for the guy who can't pee in public. I mean, here's a thought. Maybe the fact that you can't pee in public has to do with the fact that you might be incredibly thin-skinned. Okay. We have two items here that prove sometimes the law is an ass. Story number one, the Gothamist News site reports in October that bicyclist John Romer, who was rear-ended by a driver in Brooklyn in May and whose intensive care bill was paid for by the driver's insurance company, is now being sued by the driver in small claims court for $2,000 in damages to her car. Okay, we don't know if she'll win her case, but it does seem odd that this ridiculous case has even come to court. But this next story from Germany does take the cake. Odd law number two. In November, a civil case in Lindau, Germany, ordered Rory Gray to pay Dr. Daniel Urbani for calling Urbani an animal, for having injected Gray's father with 10 times the drug's safe dose in 2008, which led to his father's death. The court found the epithet unwarranted and ordered Gray to help pay Urbani's legal expenses. Wow. Do you think Germany is overcompensating for something? You know, like perhaps most of their actions through the better part of the 20th century? Someone's got a guilty political correct conscience here. Moving right along, neighbors in the Mandarin neighborhood of Jacksonville, Florida, complained to the city recently about a resident who scattered hundreds of mothballs, over 400 now at least, around her front yard, even driving over them with her car to crush them open and extend their noxious odor. The National Pesticide Information Center warned that the mothballs were hazards to plants, wildlife, water, and air. But the female resident, unnamed in a report from First Coast News, said that she was forced into the tactic in order to prevent neighborhood dogs from defecating in her yard. Okay, it's overkill in a Wile E. Coyote ordered from the Acme catalog kind of way, but what First Coast News has failed to report is if her tactic did indeed keep the dogs away. Inquiring minds would like to know. And employees of the Marshalls department store in Longmont, Colorado, said they were hearing noises and were unable to locate the source for several days until finally, on November 10th, they summoned firefighters who tore out an interior wall and freed a weak, injured Paul Felick, who was 35 years old, who had been trapped between the wall and an exterior wall after falling through the roof. A scrawled note near him was 3 days old. Burglary charges were filed against Felick, who has a substantial rap sheet. And Santa Claus, he ain't. Meanwhile, in another similar vein type of story, police in New Mexico said a woman accused of possessing a stolen truck attempted to escape custody through the ceiling of a hospital room. New Mexico State Police said 34-year-old Shailen Salazar was arrested alongside a male suspect when they were found near a stolen vehicle, and while in holding, Salazar told officers she had swallowed drugs and needed medical attention. Salazar, who was found to be concealing a pipe in her bra, was taken to Presbyterian Hospital, where she went missing later in the evening. Police searched the hospital for about an hour before discovering Salazar was hiding in the ceiling of her hospital room. Salazar, who police said admitted to possessing the stolen truck for nearly 2 months, was charged with escape and receiving or transferring a stolen vehicle. Seriously, climbing through building walls and ceilings shouldn't be something you do on a whim. For the love of God, get building plans first. That's all I'm saying. If you're going to be a criminal, do it right. But then again, that's why criminals are stupid, and thus that's why they get caught. Anyway, let's get to our next guest here on the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder, shall we? There is an actual hitchhiker in the galaxy. On November the 12th, the Philae lander hitched a ride on a speeding comet, and the European Space Agency is now working to keep tabs on the giant rock as it hurtles toward the sun. To talk about this, we are joined once again by Andrew Vazakis, the night sky guy and a member of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. He joins us via Skype to Skype communications from right here in Montreal. Hi, Andrew.
Hey, Peter.
Pretty exciting times we live in.
I know. It's just high celestial drama now.
High celestial? That sounds like something you'd see on TNT. High celestial drama. So tell us about this lander, Philae, and more importantly, why is it important?
Well, you know, what I think all the excitement's about that's got everybody on the edge of their seats is that we're vicariously living through this tiny washing machine-sized robot that touched down on this high-speed, mountain-sized ice ball that's careening through the inner solar system. And we're looking through its digital eyes and just, seeing that it's just it's an alien world that we're visiting. No human eye has ever seen it. And really what we're talking about here is a comet, which is one of the more mysterious objects that we have in our solar system. So we think there's billions of these out there, by the way, in the edge of the solar system. But we have one here that has been pulled in by the gravity of the sun and is doing a slingshot around the sun. And we've managed to place one of our robots on the surface, grasping onto it for dear life, and giving us as much science as we can. And comets are very interesting because we think they're literally time capsules, leftover remnants of a time when the Earth and all its neighboring planets were born, about 4.5 billion years ago. And at that time when the planets were forming, there were a lot of leftover bits and pieces. And some of them became asteroids that we see today, and some comets. And what's special about comets is that they are literally frozen as they were back then, billions of years ago. So here we are, we have our technology on the surface, and it's allowing us to taste and smell the comet and learn about the DNA of this comet. And by that, by understanding what it's made of, the chemistry, the geology, we're looking at what the conditions were at the birth of our solar system. And there's a lot of connection with the Earth too, Peter, because we think there's theories that say that the water on the Earth was brought by comets, because after all, they're just mountain-sized giant snowballs, and possibly even seeded Earth with the building blocks of life, organic chemistry. There, we think there's organic soup basically inside these comets, and again, that's what Philae was looking at as well. So it's a whole menagerie of all kinds of interesting questions that we have. Some of the deepest questions of how did we get there, when did we get here, and it's amazing. And this lander's helping us understand that.
Okay, so let me pull out one of my oddball analogies. I have a central vac here in my house, and it's a very large one, so I can go literally years without emptying it out, right? As I suck up all the stuff that needs to be vacuumed in the house. Is that kind of what scientists are looking at here? That this comet has basically been carrying the particles and the history of what's been going on in our universe for a certain period of time?
Yeah, I mean, the whole idea here is that this is debris, basically, you could think of from the formation of the solar system. Because these comets tend to live at the we have a donut shaped area beyond the last planet, beyond even Pluto, it's called the Oort cloud, and we think billions of comets reside there. And every once in a while, some of these comets come through the inner solar system, get stuck, and just go around the sun in highly elliptical orbits, like egg-shaped orbits around the sun. Some are relegated to the to that area close to the sun, just buzzing like bees around it, and some are much farther away in this Oort cloud. But regardless, they are basically, they hold all the chemistry of the beginnings of the solar system for billions of years. So, you know, for us to be able to crack one open, to actually look inside and test the chemistry, that's never been done before.
Okay, so
that's why it's exciting.
So now, as we mentioned, Philae is on the surface of this comet, and if I'm not mistaken, isn't Rosetta still orbiting that said comet?
Yeah, so we have the mothership. That's right, the mothership orbiter Rosetta that just remained basically released Philae. That's still in orbit and actually represents 60% of the mission itself, the total mission. So even if Philae now is passed away and if we don't ever hear from it again, it's still a huge success because it sent back most of its science, and Rosetta will continue to orbit the comet well into the end of next year, as scientists are hoping. So it's going to round the sun sometime in July of next year, reach the closest point to the sun, and then it will swing back out, heading out to the outer solar system once more, and Rosetta will continue following.
Now, as you say, it will swing past the sun as it gets close to the sun, but obviously I'm guessing it's not going to get close enough for something like Rosetta to burn up.
No, I mean, we could see some damage to Philae, more so than Rosetta, because the comet's nucleus, the head of the comet, is a very dynamic and violent landscape when it gets close to the sun. As we're seeing it right now, it's still around the orbit of Mars. It's still cold enough that there's not much activity on the surface. As it gets closer, however, in the coming months, it will start heating up as it's approaching the sun. And as it heats, the surface starts melting, it starts releasing gas pockets that are underground gas pockets, caves, that get basically exposed to the space, and they get released violently, this gas and dust, in geysers. So if you think back to some of those Hollywood movies like Armageddon, for instance, and Deep Impact, where they were actually going to a comet surface and trying to land on it, and it was like you see a hazy atmosphere and a lot of violent geysers going off. That's truly what a comet will look like. This particular comet will look like as it gets close to the sun. And so that's when Philae will actually be in great danger, I think, because all of this activity, geyser-like activity, could actually easily throw Philae off the surface.
Okay.
If it does survive that, it could still get fried a bit from the sun's heat.
Okay, so as you're saying, it's going to heat up a little bit as it gets closer to the sun. Right now, it's dormant on the surface because it's in a dark spot where its solar panels can't regenerate the battery, correct?
Yes, but one of the final commands that the European Space Agency sent to Philae, however, in the last minutes of its life, was to reposition slightly its solar panels such that they would face the sun, more chance of it facing the sun. But, of course, Philae landed right at the base of a towering cliff, and it's in its shadow, basically, almost all day.
Okay, so
why it only was able to use the battery life. But the hope is that as it gets closer to the sun, the nucleus of the comet will orient such that the spacecraft will be exposed to more sun rays and it'll reawaken.
Okay, so with it reawakening, because one of the things I found fascinating, and we're running out of time here, the fact that it was trying to dig into the comet's surface, and it's which apparently is covered in a layer of dust about 10 to 20 centimeters, but below that is very strong ice, ice that it seems that it couldn't penetrate. Could that situation change as it gets closer to the sun and things heat up?
Definitely. I mean, so as long as we can get, it can phone home again, maybe in a few months' time, we're thinking April to June of next year, we may try to drill once more because the surface will be very different. The structures could be very quite different than what we're seeing now. So that's why fingers are crossed that we get to talk to it again.
Okay. Less than a minute to go. So far, I mean, it's been a success, even though it's dormant right now and probably won't wake up, if at all, until the spring, as you just mentioned. But even with the successful landing and with Rosetta circling this comet, what's the biggest thing besides pulling this mission off? What's the biggest thing that's been learned so far?
Well, I mean, the fact that we're able to accomplish a feat like this, actually land on a high-speed comet, is amazing. Orbit a comet. These were a first. So we've never attempted this before.
Yeah, but have
and
we?
So we
but
show
have
that
we
it's
learned,
successful.
But have we learned anything about the comet itself beyond landing there?
Yeah, I mean, definitely the fact that it's very hard ice is very interesting, and that is something new. We didn't think. We thought it would be much more fragile than it is. So this could be something. Is it unique to this comet? We don't know. We this is our first sampling, but it'll be interesting to see as it heats up if that structure changes at all. Will it remain a hard ice or will it soften? So we'll add this can bode very interesting science for future in terms of us going to other comets and understanding them, because comets can potentially be dangerous. We've known that they impact the Earth in the past, and understanding how they're made will be important, because do we want to blow them up with a bomb into smithereens, or do we want to just nudge them over slightly? No, understanding their structure will help us understand how to mitigate potential disasters of oncoming collisions.
And one very last question, which you kind of basically just answered, but are there plans to visit or try to land on other comets with other landers?
There's nothing concrete at this point, but I think this is gonna set the bar very high, and I think it's gonna show that we can technologically do this, and it'll, I think, embolden space agencies to try for future missions of landing on with even bigger landers on comets.
Always a pleasure to talk to you, Andrew. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Clear skies.
Andrew Fizakis, the Night Sky Guy. You can check out his website at thenightskyguy.com. And, of course, you'll find the link on my website at thestufffile.com. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
I'm Bob DiRigo-Jones, and this is Let's Be Fair. When looking at all the ridiculous lawsuits that cross my desk every week, I'm often reminded of a quote attributed to the famous circus promoter P.T. Barnum that goes, "There's a sucker born every minute." But did you know that Barnum never actually said that? Here's the story. In the 1860s, a New York man carved a huge rock to look like a giant human being and claimed he found it buried in the ground. A banker named David Hannum bought it and began charging the public admission to see what he claimed was a real prehistoric giant. Then P.T. Barnum offered to buy it from him for his circus, but the banker refused, so Barnum made a duplicate giant and claimed he bought it from Hannum. After he started making a fortune, the banker sued him. And as for the people paying to see Barnum's giant, the banker said, "There's a sucker born every minute." Let's be fair. During the trial, it was revealed that both giants were fakes. The lesson? Don't sue a scammer if you're a scammer too. Learn more. Visit our website at centerforamerica.org.
Hi, this is Wynonna Judd, and you probably don't think of me as a person with an eating disorder, but here's my truth. Eating disorders are real, and they are not just about losing weight. Eating disorders are the way you feel about your body and the way you treat yourself. For years, I have been a compulsive overeater, and it wasn't until its effects threatened my health, my family, and my career that I finally reached out for help. Recovering from an eating disorder is possible, and I'm living proof. But you have to take the first step, so I urge you to visit nationaleatingdisorders.org.
This is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. Pay very close attention. There could be a test later.
And still to come on the program, we'll talk to the author of Chuck and Chuck, The Astonishing Tale of Charles Manson. Plus, we do indeed have an idiot of the day. And I've got a couple more Stuff File news stories right here on a program also heard on Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Police were executing a search warrant at Edward Henderson's Prattville, Alabama home. They spotted Henderson running out of the back of his house where he jumped down into a 25-foot ravine. Then Bo, Henderson's dog, came up to the officers. One of the officers pointed at Henderson and told the dog, "Go get him!" Sure enough, Bo, without hesitation, went down into the ravine, trailed by two drug enforcement investigators. Now, the officers followed Bo through the woods and caught up with him, standing next to Henderson's hiding spot, wagging his tail. Henderson was arrested without incident and charged with failure to obey police, two counts of first-degree unlawful manufacture of a controlled substance, two counts of second-degree unlawful manufacture of a controlled substance, and possession of drug paraphernalia. Bo was called a good boy, and he was given a treat. Now that's man's best friend. Not necessarily Henderson's best friend, though, but man's best friend. And finally, when a restaurant in Lawton, Oklahoma, presented Christy Rhines her bill for her food and several alcoholic drinks, police say she told the restaurant's manager that she didn't have any money, but her husband would come by and pay the tab. Her husband, she said, was Jesus Christ. She apparently didn't say when he would come, so the manager called police. Rhines was charged with fraud. You know, Jesus doesn't splurge on dining out because Jesus saves. But one has to ask, if she thought she was going to get away with this, just how much water did her husband turn into wine? Yeah. Anyway, let's get to our next guest on the Stuff File program, shall we? Several years ago on our old radio show, we talked to Mike Side, the author of Chuck and Chuck, The Astonishing Tale of Charles Manson Pitching in the Major Leagues. That was a work of fiction about Manson possessing a killer knuckleball. But as always, truth is stranger than fiction. Charles Manson is in the news these days because the 80-year-old mass murderer is about to get married. I thought it would be nice to invite Mike Side on the show, so he joins us right now from New Jersey. Hi, Mike.
Hi, how are you, Peter? Thanks for having me on.
Just tickety-boo. Thanks for being on the program with us. So when you wrote your book, this was several years ago, did you ever think something as bizarre as Charles Manson getting married would happen?
Well, as art imitating life or life imitating art would have it, no, I didn't think in real life this would ever happen. But without giving too many spoilers away about the book, something similar happens in the book. And so when I heard this, I couldn't believe it. I had to crack up. But no, I didn't think in real life this would happen. But like you say, truth is stranger than fiction.
Gee, it makes you wonder. Maybe you should go and ask somebody for royalties on what's happening in the real life.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It is kind of odd. And one thing that came to my mind is, the holidays are coming up and people are always, you get your family together and you'll have somebody who's single, and you'll be asked, like we all are, so when are you getting married? Oh, I can't find the right person. And now somebody's going to say, are you kidding me? Even Charles Manson's getting married.
Yes, and I believe one of the Menendez brothers is married too, is he not?
Oh my God, I didn't know that. I did not know that.
Yeah.
And it's funny you mention that because the Menendez brothers are actually mentioned in the book, just in passing to make an analogy.
We should mention, his blushing bride, Chuck Manson's blushing bride. Her name is Afton Elaine Burton. She's 26 years old. So that throws out the rule of marrying somebody who is twice your age plus seven, or half your age plus seven.
Oh my God. Yeah. I guess if you do the math, it's he just turned 80. So shout out to Chuck. Happy birthday. But it's incredible. I think she goes by the name Star.
Yes.
And I didn't see the whole interview, but they had an interview with her and all her reasoning and all this, and it just, you can't make this stuff up.
I'm just wondering where they're registered. I'm guessing it's Bed Bath and way beyond.
That's great. That's hysterical.
So let's bring us up to date. You wrote your book, Chuck and Chuck, The Astonishing Tale of Charles Manson Pitching in the Major Leagues. First of all, and it was published by Author House. Author House. How did this all come to be? Where did the idea come from of writing this book?
Okay, the idea came probably 10 years before I began writing it. I began in 2007. And the idea came way before that, because these criminal athletes, just criminals in the world of sports, was becoming so prevalent. When I was a kid, you know, you might remember, there'd always be an incident here and there. You know, your favorite player got arrested, or somebody would do something, and you'd say, and it would be a big deal. And then as time went by, or at least when I was older, I started noticing that it was happening so often that it wasn't even big news anymore. Now, a big crime would be news, but the mass amounts of DUIs, domestic abuse, was happening daily in all sports. And I was like, what is it going to take to, really throw the hammer down and keep these people either out of sports or have appropriate punishment? And the idea popped into my head, because I used to be a stand-up comic. I said, you know, it's going to take like Charles Manson. Like, they'll hire anybody, regardless of their background or what they do. And I said, well, you know, if Charles Manson could throw an unhittable pitch, would they still hire him? And I just toyed with that idea. And I didn't even think I would write anything about it. I used to try to write screenplays. I wasn't really a novelist. And I threw that idea out to a writer pal of mine. And he said, you know what, that's not a screenplay, that's a novel. And first I said, because I mentioned him in the foreword, in the acknowledgments, I said, you know, wow, writing a novel. And he said, no, that's a novel. And then I sat down and tried to get realistic about it. I used to go to a writer's conference called the Maui Writers Conference, and I brought three ideas to the table to this publisher. And I said, okay, I have this idea, another idea, and then a really crazy one. So he didn't like the first two ideas, and then he goes, okay, tell me the crazy one. And I sort of recited the log line, which is just the pitch, and as soon as I said it, you know, Charles Manson pitching in the major leagues, he cracked up and he said, send me a sample, write, you know, 60 pages or 30 pages. And that's what got me going. That's basically how it started.
Some people might say this is a far-fetched idea. I say it's only far-fetched if you didn't make him a left-hander.
Yeah, really. Well, you know, choosing how he would throw, it had to be a knuckleball. And again, when I first started writing it seriously, I said, well, okay, the guy's 74 years old, he was 74 at the time. I said, that's so unrealistic. And again, I ran it by my friend, and he said, wait, it's so far-fetched anyway. Don't make it like back in time, like he's younger. It's so ridiculous anyway and absurd, because it's a satire, that just make him this age. Because what's crazier, that he's Charles Manson pitching in the major leagues, or that he's a 74-year-old man? So that made it easier to just, you know, forget about the age. And then I said, well, let's make him throw a knuckleball, because then you just flip it up there. And then, you know, kind of snowballed, because a knuckleball is kind of like it's like a psych-out pitch anyway. And that's what he's all about, you know, with his leadership of that demented group and all that. So, that's basically how I fit it into a story that could be somewhat workable.
I'm betting his catcher never waved off his pitches. Now, I'm wondering, I'm wondering, since the book's been out for a while now, anytime Charles Manson is in the news, do you see a bump in sales? Because, you know, nowadays we have the web, and everyone goes searching on the web. And when Charles Manson comes up, chances are your book will come up.
Right. What I'll do is when he's in the news, I'll kind of throw something out there on my Twitter account. I do have a page that's running. I call it Athlete Arrest of the Day. And sadly, almost every day I could find something. I used to hunt for any type of arrest of an athlete, whether it's college, sports that maybe aren't as popular and put it up there. And then I said, you know what, that's almost too much. And sadly, I get to see these big stories like Adrian Peterson or Ray Rice and this kind of thing so often. So I'm always using this Twitter feed to post a new athlete the rest of the day. But when Charles Manson himself is in the news, I do that as well. And I do notice a sale here or there when something like that happens.
Well, speaking of athletes' arrests of the day, are you an NFL fan, by the way?
I am. I'm a Jet fan, so you can.
No, I asked if you were an NFL fan. I didn't say the Jets.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, exactly. I sit there proudly. I still wear my Joe Namath jersey and a bag over my head, but you have to suffer. If you love the team. But and that brings up the. I don't know if you were heading to the Michael Vick thing, but being a Jet fan, I have a. Going back to Michael Vick. I finished the first draft of my book before that even happened. And while we were editing and going over the galleys and really getting to the nitty gritty, that happened. And I had time to like insert something in there about that because, I just had to. And being a Jet fan, when they signed him, I wasn't happy. I know everybody deserves to make a living. He did, he did do his time. It's really a predicament, what do you do? But when I sit there watching, I just don't know what to think. What do you think,
Yeah. The reason why I brought up the NFL is because I know the NFL's got a problem these days with image, and they like to toss on those throwback uniforms. And maybe they should rethink that, because when I saw Pittsburgh, it did look like a chain gang on the field.
That's a good point. It looked like I didn't know if it was a bumblebee, but yeah, chain gang. For sure, yeah.
Have you by any chance sent a copy of the book to Charles Manson?
I'm always asked that, and sometimes I'm tempted to. I don't know if I should go down that route. Do I want to break the wall of, my little satirical novel to really reach out to the person? Am I interested in really, being involved with him in reality? I don't know. But it did occur to me this week, why don't I just, send one book to him as a wedding present and see what happens. Maybe, I'm sure it would be intercepted because I'm sure security will look at it, but maybe they'd see it and, be some kind of a press on it or something. So I toyed with the idea, but I've never done it.
Well, writing a book called Chuck and Chuck, The Astonishing Tale of Charles Manson Pitching in the Major Leagues, apparently is a gift for you that keeps on giving, right?
Yeah, oh my God, yeah. And you know what? Part of me is not happy about it because this subject matter just will not go away. It will not go away. And that's the sad part. I don't know how you feel about it. I know you're a sports fan and you're a newsman, but it's just one after another. And then when does it end? What do they do about it? Commissioners always get criticized. The book also touches on steroids, which is also an issue. What do they do? I don't know. I guess what has to happen is fans all turn their backs on sports and say, we're just fed up, and the golden goose gets killed and there's no more sports, and they trace it to the fact that, so many people in these leagues are just, have these major character flaws. But I don't know if that's the answer. I'm still a fan. I still root for my teams. I'm a Yankee fan. You have A-Rod as far as steroids go, but is part of me rooting that he comes back this year and hits 40 home runs and they win the World Series? Of course. So maybe I'm a hypocrite too.
Okay. Well, Mike, thank you very much for being on the program with us. It's a pleasure to talk to you again.
Oh, it was great having being on your show, and I really appreciate the time. Thanks a lot, Peter.
Mike Side, author of Chuck and Chuck, The Astonishing Tale of Charles Manson. You can go to my website at thestufffile.com, go to the What's On page for this show, which is show number 0275, and you'll find links to either Amazon.com or Amazon.ca, where you can order his book directly. You're listening to The Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Time now for The Idiot of the Day.
And now it's time for The Strange Things Adults Do. The Stuff File presents The Idiot of the Day.
38-year-old Selena Edwards says when she went and bought a cup of coffee at a McDonald's in Fontana, California, they didn't secure the lid properly and it spilled on her hand, causing second-degree burns. You know where this is going, don't you? Yeah. She turned in a claim against the restaurant asking for $10,000 in compensation and included photos of painful-looking burns to back up her story. The chain's insurance company was suspicious and referred the case to state insurance fraud investigators. We discovered that some of the photos were from a hospital website, State Insurance Commissioner David Jones said. We contacted her medical provider and discovered that she hadn't received any medical treatment. Rather than get a fat payday, Edwards was instead charged with 21 felony counts of insurance and workers' compensation fraud. So, now she's really in hot water, isn't she? Yeah. Irony. Why, oh why, would someone attempt such a lame insurance fraud case and not know that it would be thoroughly investigated before the possibility of ever seeing a single solitary dime? Well, one reason, and one reason only. She's an idiot!
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program number 0275. Hope you enjoyed it. The website is thestufffile.com, and once again, stuff is spelled S-T-U-P-H, where you'll find information and links on all of our guests by going to the weekly Stuff File page. Just look for the corresponding program number, and once again, that's 0275. Email me at peter@thestufffile.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter as P.A. Holder. And don't forget to check out the Stuff File store, where you can purchase a plethora of Stuff File merchandise, from t-shirts to mugs to tote bags to mouse pads. Hope to see you back here for our next show on the air, online, or as a download. We're coming to you from everywhere, including CyberStationUSA.com, KDXRadio.com, AirChecker, Canada's number one radio source, streaming on PCJ Media and its partner stations, TrueTalkRadio.com, downloaded on iTunes and Stitcher, and over the air on World FM in New Zealand, MediaCorp in Singapore, and WSTJ in St. Johnsbury, Vermont. That's it. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. No animals were harmed in the production of this program, except, of course, the tasty ones. Good night and pass the paprika.